So, Berto, I just heard. I'm on Reddit.
You're on Reddit?
Well, that's my place I go to look at the internet.
That's your 4chan?
Yeah. I started seeing all of these posting about Chris Cornell's music. So,
right.
Chris Cornell Unplugged, an old Soundgarden song.
And you're like, oh, that's interesting.
And I'm like, and after like the third post, I'm like, why are all these random people posting about Chris Cornell? And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, he must have died.
Right.
Because on Reddit, the only reason why something like that would happen would be because something horrible had happened. And so I looked it up, and in fact,
because even if they put out a new album, it just wouldn't bubble up like that.
Right, especially, yeah. So he has died. He died yesterday. And I just wanted to talk about it on the podcast.
Suicide,
and that's what it very much appears to be at this point.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And I also just want to talk about Chris Cornell's career and our interaction with it. He's from Seattle. He's one of the Seattle greats.
Ritual!
And so, and he also did impressions of birds, kind of like what Berto just did. And so I thought we could talk about that sort of thing. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I'm a typographist.
So the thing before we start into this is the last time this happened, it was either Prince or David Bowie. I had just heard that, I think it was Prince, that he had died just before we started recording. And so it was with Rebecca, I think. You weren't here. And we just started to just talk about it because I just wanted to talk about it. And then people on the internet, of course, I get daily messages from people telling me about how I got some fucking fact wrong or something, you know, like, you know, Prince's or David Bowie's or whoever it was. But it'll be like, so-and-so's album wasn't that year. It was this other year. And Ziggy Stardust was not this sort of thing. It was that sort of thing. And all I have to say to you fucking internet people is this. If you come to a psychology podcast in which I'm just riffing about something to learn about the facts about someone, anyone's life, you can go to hell. There's a thing called Wikipedia plus 10,000 other websites you can go to find...
It's wikipedia.org.
To find facts. You don't come to a stupid podcast to listen to facts. And the other thing is people, in all likelihood, I recorded those episodes months, if not years ago. I don't give a fuck if I got something wrong, somewhat, especially on if it's about a popular figure. Amy Winehouse died when she was 27, not 28. And it's like, you know, Harry Potter's Patronus was blah, 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 not this blah, blah. Do you know how many messages I get about the Harry Potter episode? We're here to talk about psychology.
Are you the worst prosecuted, the most persecuted podcaster in history?
No, I can't imagine what more popular internet people get.
Is this a witch hunt like none other?
It's just stupid. So I just want to say, I just figured this out like 15 minutes ago. Started, pressed record. We're going to record and just lay off. So, and I'm sure Chris Cornell would agree with me when I tell y'all to fuck off. He had many songs in which he told people to fuck off. So there we go.
Like Black Hole Moon.
Yeah. So the first time I saw Chris Cornell, I was at Bumbershoot 1990.
Whoa.
And I went to Bumbershoot because I wanted to see the Posies. Remember the Posies?
Yeah.
The Posies had just come out with Dear 23, the album before Frosting on a Beater. And, the Frosting on a Beater was probably their biggest album. It was I Can Dream All Day.
All day.
But Dear 23 was probably my favorite album. And it's a great album. And so I go to see the Posies play there. It's in Key Arena. But Bumbershoot is this big music festival in Seattle. It's been going on forever. Bumbershoot is another word for umbrella. I've come to learn. And so I'm watching the Posies, and there's all these punk guys, these guys in black and shaved heads.
Was Posies Jealousy too? Did they do, hey, jealousy?
No, my God.
Okay, that was, what was their name?
That was, that's a terrible, that's like, I mean, they're fine, but.
What was their name? Because I saw them at UW.
I don't know, but they're nothing
Gin
like
Blossom.
The Posies. Gin Blossom.
Oh, no, no, sorry. I saw the Posies at UW, but I was expecting to hear the Gin Blossom song.
That's funny.
That was in 93.
Now, the Posies have a very sophisticated Beatles-esque
yeah.
sort of writing style that didn't go over well with the public, my opinion, because it's a little too sophisticated.
Can you imagine right now the rage of people that I confuse the Posies with Gin Blossom?
Well, all you got to see is the look on my face. Because the Gin Blossoms, they're
whoa,
fine.
Whoa.
I mean, I liked Gin Blossoms songs, but that's like...
I can't believe you confused the Gin Blossoms.
I mean, that's like comparing, I don't know, like Britney Spears to, I don't know, like Michael Jackson.
I'm the worst treated podcaster in history.
Anyway, So anyway, I go to see the Posies, and I'm kind of annoyed with the crowd, because the crowd in the right in front of the stage, it's all these punk guys who oh. don't who like. There's me with my, I don't know what you call it, alt rock sensibilities,
right.
You know, not heavy metal, not into heavy metal, not into punk. I'm into things like the Posies
right.
and the Beatles and the Sundays and. The Thompson, or not Thompson Twins, Cocteau Twins.
Oh, yeah.
New Order, you know, Depeche Mode, that kind of thing. And so there's us
right.
that are there to see the Posies, which is another local band. And the Posies, I thought, were going to be the biggest band from Seattle, but we were. This was just before Nirvana
right,
had Nevermind. Nevermind was the next year. And so there's all these, like, asshole punk guys who are in the front yelling at the Posies while they're playing, telling them to get off stage.
Oh,
yeah. And they're just like, boo, get off the stage. And John Auer, the lead singer of the Posies, whom I've seen in very small clubs in Seattle in the last 10 years, he starts yelling at the crowd. He's just like, you know, every time you boo, it just makes me want to play another song.
It just makes us stronger.
Yeah. And so I totally respected that, because it was very awkward, you know? Because if John Auer just, and Ken Stringfellow, if they just sort of were like, come on, guys.
Come
or,
on.
Or if they ignored it, it would look bad. But they just came right back at him. They're just like,
nice.
Fuck you. This is our set. You could go home if you want to. You know what I mean? Just
so
like,
they still had that Seattle attitude.
Yeah, yeah.
But with the you know, the nice music.
With nice long hair instead of the angry Soundgarden long hair. So then the next band comes on, and it's Soundgarden. And that's when I realized what was happening was, like, the crowd wanted to see Soundgarden.
Oh.
And Soundgarden at the time, 1990, this is before they were big, you know.
Is this Bad Motorfinger time?
No, way before that. Or
oh, really?
Not way before, but, you know, before that. This is after Louder Than Love, which was their big album that they came out, you know. And so, yeah, this is before Bad Motorfinger, before mm-hmm. Super Unknown, before Down on the Upside. And I'd known Soundgarden because there were a handful of local bands that everyone knew about. You knew about, you know, Nirvana. You knew about Mudhoney. Mm-hmm. You knew about Tad. You know,
like, Mudhoney was bigger than Nirvana initially, right?
Totally. Nirvana was a shit, tiny little crap band. And no one expected Nirvana to be
right.
the band that came out with the biggest album of all time. That would actually rocket everyone else with him, including Soundgarden to some extent. But
right.
but Soundgarden was one of those bands. So I thought the Posies were going to be big, but actually Soundgarden actually had a pretty good following. But it was a metal following.
Yeah.
And, you know, normal soccer moms don't listen to metal. Do you know what I mean? And so no one's going to listen to this band. And they had kind of a really hardcore punk following.
They're aggressive. Very
yeah,
aggressive.
It was like now if you go to a Soundgarden show, or even just 5 years after this point, it would have been like, you know, your everyday kind of people.
Yeah.
But at this point, it was like very, you know, they call it a mosh pit now, right?
Yeah, right.
In the 90s, they started calling it a mosh pit.
What was it called then?
It wasn't called anything then. It was just like the place in front of the stage. And I remember no one called it moshing. No one called it a mosh pit. You just called it like the place where the punks like to punch people, you know? And so me and my friends, actually Chris Glover, whom you know, and David Broadhead, I think it was him, maybe not. But anyway, we decide to kind of go into this crowd and see this Soundgarden band. And I, you know, again, I'd heard of them kind of, but I didn't know any of their songs. And I just wanted to get into that pit because it looked it looked really exciting.
Sure.
So we enter. There's sort of a in every mosh pit. There's a zone between the stander arounders, the innocent people who don't enter the zone of the mosh pit, and then the where the mosh pit begins.
Oh.
And when you and you cross that line, and that's when violence starts to occur, right? And there and so we end. We I remember we're kind of making our way through the crowd, trying to get up to the front because there's a lot of people. Soundgarden's playing, and I cross the line, and instantly all three of us get completely separated.
Oh man!
Because the it was like whenever they depict heat, kinetic energy, mm-hmm. with molecules.
That's you guys bouncing off of everything,
right? You know, like you slow down the gas molecules, and they slowly start to. You know, they get quiet, but then, you know, you give them a lot of heat and they're just bouncing all up. And that was just like, and you threw three other molecules in there and
bam,
boom, like all of them, we just got scattered. And I don't think I saw them again for a long time.
Wow.
I make my way to the front and I'm just getting beat up. People are like not punching me, but
just slamming into
slamming, but close slamming. Like in, yeah. in like a lot of slam pits, you'll see people with space around there. There was such a press of people. And everyone was cramming, like bouncing, just. And I remember the next day, I had bruises all up and down my body, like every inch of my body. And to get a little graphic here, I had a hat on my head, and I was getting crunched downstairs, if you know what I'm saying.
Yo!
And so I put my hat down my pants.
To protect like a cup. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And
that's hilarious.
And so I'm listening to sound. I'm just,
well, what kind of hat? Like a baseball cap?
It was like a,
or a
like
fedora.
A stocking, like a yeah, it was like a cowboy hat. No, it was like a stocking cap or something.
Okay.
Whatever you call those things.
Oh, like yeah, those wool. Wearing yes, like the The kind that...
Like a ski cap, you know.
What's that band? If you want to rock for hours, just go ahead now. Two Princes or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
God. That guy wore that kind of stuff all the
time. You're just going down a worse and worse 90s road with these terrible bands. You know, I always forget the name of that band. And every time I hear it, I'm like, okay, remember that band name. And, and I can't recall it, but I'm glad that I can't. Anyway.
The song's Two Princes. Anyways.
Yeah.
But so you're... Do you realize my first concert ever was The Cure?
Yeah.
And do you know I got to go to the front?
Yeah.
And I it was a mosh pit, but it wasn't because it was The Cure.
Yeah.
But still, everyone was still kind of crushing, so I had to like sit there. It was like a workout.
Was that like 91, 92?
91, I think, yeah.
I went to that concert, too.
We were right there.
It was Key Arena.
Maybe you were pushing... Yeah. Maybe you were pushing me against the...
Yeah. I just remember there's a lot of pot. That's all I remember. But that's interesting, yeah.
Which, by the way, at the time, I didn't know what pot smelled like or what it looked like.
Yeah.
So I was like, why... Are there dead things here? Like, it smelled so bad.
Yeah. Anyway, so getting to Chris Cornell, I'm looking up at him from, you know, the front of the stage, and I'm just like, my God, this guy is, he's a rock god.
Yeah, right?
He's like the next Robert Plant or something. He just had this charisma, and he could sing, and this music, you know, and they had this Japanese bassist, which was, I thought was just so cool. And
he was good looking and probably tall. I don't know how tall he was, but he looked tall.
Oh, yeah.
Long hair.
Long Jesus hair.
Was he shirtless?
That goatee.
Probably.
Absolutely. And so I'm getting bounced around and the music and, you know, it's all these punk guys. And then all of a sudden, everyone reaches up into the air with their arms at the same time. And I don't know what's
happening.
And they go, fuck, 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 fuck you, fuck you. The entire mosh pit at the same time. And I'm looking around and I'm like, how is everyone knowing this choreographed, you know, thing? And then I realize that's the song. It's this song, Big Dumb Sex by Soundgarden, on their Louder Than Love album. And the chorus is, fuck you.
I see.
And everyone's screaming this, and I'll just never forget. It just, everyone stopped being violent with each other just long enough. Yeah. So anyway.
Sounds like a Dashboard Confessional show, but a little different.
Yeah. So anyway, Soundgarden, you know, they got their name from a sculpture that is in Magnuson Park. Have you ever been?
Oh, okay.
Have you ever been there before?
Yeah, yeah.
There's this, it's this.
But I had no idea that that was the connection.
Oh, okay. It's called A Soundgarden, and it's these large metal whistle.
Yeah,
kind
I've
of
seen
things.
That. Oh, I just okay. never knew what it was called.
Oh, yeah. It's called A Soundgarden, and so that's where they got their name from.
Mm.
Then Bad Motorfinger comes out, and that right. was their big album that kind of got them onto the map because it had, you know, Spoon Man, Rusty Cage,
that's right,
Jesus Christ Pose, that kind of stuff, and so they for the first and partially I'm guessing because they were from Seattle and Nirvana was just so
right.
big. But I remember watching MTV and like you'd walk up to Sharon Stone or something and who's your favorite Seattle band? You know, just like on a red carpet.
Right.
Yeah, that was the thing of the month was like, who's yeah. your favorite grunge band? And basically it came down between Soundgarden or Nirvana. You had your Soundgarden people and you had your Nirvana people.
Yeah, and then there's Pearl Jam after that.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah. You had your Pearl Jam. Yeah. yeah. So Pearl Jam was huge. Nirvana was huge. And like Soundgarden yeah. was like a third or something.
So I remember seeing... well, first of all, I love the videos on MTV. But then I remember when I saw Singles.
Right.
And there's that scene where they're in the club and he's singing Ritual.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that a real... But I didn't know it was Soundgarden. I was like, yeah. that can't be real. Is that a real person singing that?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Yeah. Yeah. He's in that movie. So just a little bit on the news. He had a rock festival in suburban St. Louis. No, sorry. He had a sound just looking. Maryland, Missouri. So Maryland Heights, Missouri. They were, what's our schedule? Fuck. I don't know what I'm reading. Anyway, they found him in a hotel room. And let's see, a medical examiner determined that Cornell killed himself by hanging in Detroit. So a show in Detroit. Mm. And then just hours later, that night in his hotel room, it seems as though he killed himself.
Man.
He was 52 years old. He had been suffering from depression and social,
that's what I was wondering.
Social phobias and drug and alcohol addiction his entire life. I remember he was one of the big heroin addicts back in the day.
Yeah. Have you seen anything about like heavy heroin use leads to depression, or is it depression leads to heavy heroin use?
Both. Any addiction ongoing will complicate your depression or even cause it, because one, the consequences of drug addiction are quite severe. The stigma, the pushing people away, the shame, that can be in itself a cause for depression. Mm. But also your brain chemistry is altered as such that when you engage in long-term substance abuse, particularly things like heroin and alcohol, there will be times where your brain is trying to adjust and the adjustments can cause deeper depressions.
I see.
Yeah. So what I suspect, and again, this is just speculation, is that he had been thinking about, I'm sure reports will come out, but I'm guessing that he had been thinking about suicide at least off and on for decades.
Oh, man.
And had been successfully, you know, pushing past it. But I think, again, speculation based on my experience with other situations like this, was he made a decision a long time ago that he was going to do it. He might have even had other times, because it all seems so sudden. It's like he's at a concert, everything's fine, and then hours later, he's found. It seems like, well, that can't be suicide. It doesn't make any sense. Well, how could you go out? Well, people who have strong suicidal thoughts can just, you know, they can persevere. Partially because they've had suicidal thoughts that have been intense for years and years and years.
So it's not unusual.
Yeah. So to them, it's something that is just par for the course. And And so it seems to me that, you know, he made a decision a long time ago, is my guess, and for whatever reason thought this would be a good time to do it.
Oh, man.
It's weird because, like, he tweeted just before the show saying, like, let's rock Detroit or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so there's no indication. But, you know, maybe some reports will come out saying that there was some foul play.
Yeah.
Because, of course, that's always a question when it's like there's... Because we haven't heard about any kind of suicide note or anything.
True,
And his family didn't know anything was happening.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
Did he have kids?
Yeah, he had three kids, I believe, from two different women.
Mm.
So this is, you know, obviously Kurt Cobain, Layne Staley.
Yeah, right.
The lead singer of
what's the Stone...
Stone Temple Pilots. Yeah, that guy.
Stapp or Stapp Scott, what's his name?
Scott
Stapp something. No.
Scott something. Yeah. And so it's a sad day, and that's really most of it. Yeah, a lot of his songs actually had a lot of death themes in it, which is common to heavy metal and to that kind of music, but. He has a song called Like Suicide. And my favorite song is called Boot Camp. And it's on Down on the Upside, which was their last really good album. So it's so there are 16 tracks on on that album, yeah. And they by this time they had completely gone experimental and wrote really excellent songs. Yeah, there's not a lot of...
See, I don't know. I honestly mostly knew Super Unknown and a couple of previous songs, and that was it.
Right, because Super Unknown's the big album because it has Black Hole Sun. Spoon Man's on Super Unknown. Bad Motorfinger just has Rusty Cage and Outshined and Jesus Christ, both. Sorry. So all those people on the internet, they're going to fucking blast this. They've already commented below this on YouTube saying, Spoon Man's on Super Unknown, idiot.
Idiot.
Get a book.
That's
my favorite. That's my favorite internet insult.
Get a book.
It's like, God, really?
So I have a memory where it was my sophomore year of college. I had moved in with my friend Dave, Korean Dave, you know?
Yeah.
And above, I think two floors above us, there were these two guys that we met. And one of their names was Ed. And Ed looked like Chris Cornell, like if he had short hair, where Chris Cornell did have short hair for a period. So he looked kind of like Chris Cornell. And I remember I was so jealous of this fact. But so my other friend, Chong, who might be listening to this, they were like, yeah, Ed totally looks like Chris Cornell. I'm like, not really. I don't really see it. I was like, God damn it.
That's funny. So looking at the set list, I found the set list from 1990, September 3rd, Bumbershoot, Seattle. And in fact, their fifth song, Big Dumb Sex, the Fuck, Fuck, Fuck You song. Other songs that they played, I think during their encores, they played Inagata Da Vida by Iron Butterfly.
Nice.
But they teased it, so they just started it, apparently. They played Communication Breakdown by Led Zeppelin.
Nice.
Communication Breakdown. And their second to last song, Big Bottom by Spinal Tap. Do you know that song?
I remember the...
Big Bottom.
Yeah.
Big... Oh, that's a clear song. And their last song, Jesus Is All Right by the Art Reynolds Singers.
Is that the... Wait. Jesus is just all right with me.
Is that it?
Just all right.
That's something hilarious, like that. Yeah. So anyway, he grew up, actually, he went to Shorewood High School, which is nearby. I used to live downtown, but now I live in the suburbs, and
that's right.
Shorewood High School is actually pretty close to here. He had, I think, some trouble growing up in his family, and he, early in life, engaged in drug abuse, heroin, and alcohol. I mean, I remember hearing about him in the 90s. People would just say, yeah, Chris Cornell. I remember there would be reports about Chris Cornell going on these long heroin bouts.
I seem to remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and how...
Because he did disappear for a bit, right? Like, he was, you know, Soundgarden was going and stuff like that. And then when he came back, it was like the Audioslave stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then he did a few solo things. I remember when he did the Bond song. Yeah. But he wasn't... He did sort of like recede from prominence here and there. Yeah. Maybe he was going through bouts of...
When I was in a band in the early 90s, as every other guy was in Seattle, I played at this one club. They called it, it was called the Ditto.
The Ditto?
The Ditto. And it was owned by this guy, and I can't remember his name, but he had this club in Seattle, and it was called the Ditto. And it was back before, so in the like late 80s, early 90s, there were only three places that Soundgarden, Nirvana, Mudhoney could play in Seattle. Mm. They could play at the Ditto, and they could play at the OK Hotel, and they could play at Central.
Oh, okay.
Now, and or fast forward 4 or 5 years, there were clubs for rock bands in every sub, you know,
sure,
borough in Seattle. You know, yeah, there were just everywhere. I mean, like when we started playing, one of our favorite places, the two favorite places we ever played was this Chinese restaurant and this Indian restaurant. The Indian restaurant was in Pioneer Square, so okay, that kind of made sense. But the Chinese restaurant was in Ballard. But they had this really great stage and great sound system and stuff.
And it was a restaurant.
Yeah, it was called the New World. But so all these, you know, Indian restaurants, Chinese restaurants, everyone was like inviting grunge into, wow, into their lives. But there was a time when there's only three places. And so when we would play at the Ditto, we would hang out with the owner sometimes, and he would take us into the back. And so he owned almost an entire block in Belltown right underneath the monorail.
Oh, wow.
And he, in the back, had a bigger space than his club. Uh-huh. But he never used it except for his hoarding. He had...
Oh, no.
He hoarded newspapers. So he would every...
Like clinical hoarder kind of thing? Like, well, you could barely walk or...
I mean, we could get into the definition, yeah, yeah, of hoarding disorder, which, you know, is an actual DSM thing, but... But, you know, I'll just say what he did, okay, you know, call it what you will. But he would collect stacks of newspapers, Seattle Times, uh-huh, Seattle PI, every day. And he stacked them fairly neatly in all these stacks, which resulted in a mountain of newspapers.
Oh,
and they were all stacked. And so you could climb on this mountain. It was probably 20 feet by 20 feet.
Oh my God.
And probably like 8 feet high.
Why didn't he just scan them and put them up on the internet?
Yeah. And so we would sit back there and smoke cigarettes and...
on a pile of flammable newspapers.
And drink his weird alcohol. I remember he actually introduced me to Kalamata olives. You know, like... You know,
sure,
like back in the 80s, you had black olives and green olives.
Yes.
And... You know, and most people hated green olives.
Sure.
And Kalamata olives were like,
what?
Really, it was like really gross. But I remember he was Italian, and so he wanted to start selling these in his bar. And he would put like three Kalamata olives in this, you know, those plastic little bowls that you use for ketchup at McDonald's or something.
And he would put them in there.
Yeah. And I remember he was like, you got to have these. And then we're just kind of like, wow, these are strong, you know. Anyway, so we'd sit back there, smoke cigarettes, drink his weird alcohol, and we would talk about his experiences just a couple years earlier with all those bands.
Oh, wow.
Nirvana, you know, Soundgarden, Mother Love Bone, and he was really close with Andrew Wood from Mother Love Bone.
Right.
So there's another Seattle guy who died.
He was also suicide? Oh, overdose. It was overdose.
I think so, overdose.
Yeah.
And I think Andrew Wood and Chris Cornell were really close. Because when Mother Love Bone dissolved because of Andrew Wood, Chris Cornell joined a lot of those guys and they formed
Temple of
the Dog. Oh, yeah. And so he was telling me about, he claimed, I think his name was Paletti, if I remember right. So long ago. But anyway, he was telling me that he gave Andrew Wood his first joint, which led to eventual heroin, which led to eventual dying. But he also said Chris Cornell and all these other guys. And I just remember me and the other guitarist in my band, we would just listen to him. And he was like some kind of
A guru.
Yeah, and he had a gray beard, you know, to go yeah. with it and everything. He just seemed like this master of grunge, you know.
Ah, that's so funny.
And the song that would get him going, he had a jukebox, and we would put it in the jukebox whenever we went there. We'd go there after hours, like the bars would shut down, and we would go there and knock on the door. And
that's a good friend to have.
Yeah. And the one song that would always get him going was Sky Pilot by Eric Burden and the Animals.
Oh.
Sky Pilot. And just seeing that guy with that gray beard just jumping around like a gnome or something in his own club. Like,
that's hilarious. Have you seen him since? Like, did you ever see him again?
Or? No. I think he ran for office. I started seeing his name. I don't know if it was a similar guy. Anyway,
if he owned a big piece of that area, he must have made some bank.
Yeah. So what else can we say about Soundgarden? You can't really attribute all of Soundgarden's greatness to Chris Cornell himself.
Oh, no. The rhythms are unbelievable in their songs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Kim Thayil, Ben Shepherd, Matt Cameron, all four of those guys are geniuses, really, especially Ben Shepherd, the bassist. When he joined the band, he really brought that experimental vibe to them.
I got to say, so actually that was the first thing that stood out when I heard their music that was different from the others, it was that it was so rhythmically interesting.
Right.
I was like, what? I could barely even follow it. I'm like, that is so cool.
Well, not only that, because that's a metal thing, but it actually had chordal sophistication.
Yeah, right.
And the first song that I heard it in was Outshined. So, you know, Outshined is... You know, Outshine! Outshine! And so, you know, pretty typical grunge, you know, slow metal, because that's what grunge was slow metal. But then it has this bridge. The dun-dun-dun... Dun, dun, dun. And then, you hear chords. You hear actual interesting, kind of like alternative rock chords that are sort of shoved into this metal song, you know? And that's when I was like, whoa, what is this band? What is Soundgarden doing? And I think that was a lot of Ben Shepherd stuff.
Interesting.
But yeah, by the time Down on the Upside came out, I mean, they were so just expressing this genius stuff. At the end of this episode, so Boot Camp, when Down on the Upside came out, I loved this song so much. So it's the last Soundgarden album on their last album. I covered it, actually.
Oh, wow.
On my 4-track cassette recorder.
Oh, you mean you covered it, you re-recorded each song, your own version of it?
No, just Boot Camp, just the song Boot Camp.
Oh, just Boot Camp, okay.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the lyrics are really appropriate to the situation. And at the end of this episode, I'll play my version.
Your cover?
Because we don't have the rights to
play. Yeah, of course.
But anyway, here are the lyrics. It's very simple. I must obey the rules. I must be tame and cool. Here it says cook, but I'm pretty sure it's cool.
That's a saying. I must be cook.
Yeah, what?
I'm pretty cook. I'm a pretty cook guy.
I must obey the rules. I must be tame and cool. No staring at the clouds. I must stay on the ground. In clusters of the mice, the smoke is in our eyes. Like babies on display, like angels in a cage. I must be pure and true. I must contain my views. There must be something else. There must be something good far away.
Oh.
Far away from here. Far away. Far away from here. And then there's a final line in there. But so, you know, internet, Google music doesn't even have the right lyrics. But
yeah.
But anyway, so it ends with that. There must be something good far away. There must be something else.
I see.
And so that's what we'll end with. But do you have anything else you want to say about Chris Cornell, Berto?
Let's see. Well, you know, at the time where all this was happening, I was still in high school in Tacoma. And I went to, I think we talked about before, my swim coach was, his last name was Stauffer. He was Aaron Stauffer's dad, from what's it, Seaweed? Mm-hmm. Isn't that the name of the Tacoma band?
I don't know.
There was this kind of famous grunge band from Tacoma. I think it was Seaweed.
Not that famous.
they were famous enough. They
well, you lived in Tacoma at the time, so.
No. Like, they were Seattle famous, I should say.
I never heard of them. Seaweed.
But anyways, my point is that all the older, like the seniors, I would hear them talking a lot about these bands, and I would hear things like Mother Love Bone and all these other things, and I would have no idea what was going on because I was with the Depeche Mode crowd and the Erasure crowd and all these things, and for us, I was sort of upset because like Violator is one of my favorite albums of all time, and I didn't really like Songs of Faith and Devotion, so I was sitting there going like, hey, where's I want more of my kind of music. Where's more of my kind of music? And so the only thing that was really coming out that I was really latching onto was like Nine Inch Nails, maybe even Marilyn Manson or stuff like this. And I was totally not paying attention to grunge because I was like, oh, it's that new scene, that grunge thing. I don't even get it. So it took me till 93 when I went to college to finally be like, fine, I'll listen to some of this stuff. And then I really liked I loved, actually Soundgarden was one of the only ones that I already actually really liked because it sort of poked out of that. But I had even missed the Smashing Pumpkins because I grouped them in the whole grunge thing.
Oh man.
Yeah, I know.
That first Smashing Pumpkins album, Gish, I listened to it and I didn't understand it and hated it. I hated it at first. I was just like, what is this? It's kind of like Jane's Addiction. I even thought it was kind of like Guns N' Roses in a sense.
Oh, weird.
But, you know, because like back then there was nothing else to compare it to.
Sure.
But I really compared it to Jane's Addiction. And I'll never forget, I'm listening to it, and Snail, there's a song called Snail, mm-hmm. like it's track 7 or something on Gish. And when that, and there was something, I just, you know, back then you have like 15 CDs you can listen
sure.
to, right? And so you just have to listen to it even if you don't like it. And then all of a sudden, it just hit me between the eyes. And I was like, this is the best album of all time. Like, it all started to make sense to me. And I was a massive Smashing Pumpkins fan.
Eventually, I became Shun, my friend Shun.
Okay.
This is probably after
Siamese Dream.
Maybe. This is in 93. He force-fed me several bands, and I was like, Okay, I like it. And then I really liked it.
Okay.
Because
it's not really your thing though, even to this day. I mean, if you just wanted to play like music, you know, that you want to listen to, you wouldn't pop in a Smashing Pumpkins album, would you?
No, that's true. I mean, certain songs I really love, but I definitely like if you grab me on a random day, Berto, play a song, it'll be some song from the 80s that I can sing to.
Something lighter, let's just say. Yeah.
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah. Which is great. You know, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that's just your...
That's my average choice.
That's your thing, yeah. For me, I have a massive, like, heavy metal side to me. Like Smashing Pumpkins, like Husker Du. Actually, I think Husker Du is what opened my eyes to melodic hard music.
Interesting.
And so when Nirvana and all these other bands came out, and Jane's Addiction actually was before a lot of the grunge bands.
Were you a Jane's Addiction fan?
Yeah.
Oh, so Jane's Addiction sort of scared me.
Yeah.
Because when I watched that video, the first thing I ever heard of Jane's Addiction was being caught stealing once when I was 5, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And I was watching the video, and there are so many things that were foreign and weird to me. Like, why is he cross-dressing? Why is he wearing women's clothes? And then, is he actually stealing from a store? And then it's like, and then the dogs, and it's like, they're doing illegal stuff. These guys are not for me. They're not good.
Well, I've always had a nihilistic, anarchic thread in my life, and so... All that kind of stuff. Public Enemy actually gave me a similar feeling back then. But anyway, yeah. Well, okay, so let's conclude. And again, this wasn't an episode that was supposed to provide you the story of Chris Cornell. In fact, I talked more about myself in this episode than I talked about Chris Cornell. It's a sad thing that he passed away. He was an amazing singer. I mean, we, you know, just YouTube his various different unplugged performances. He could play an acoustic guitar very well. Mm-hmm. That one song that's actually on the single soundtrack is just amazing.
Yes.
And he's an amazing guitarist, an amazing singer, and even into his 50s, he could still just totally nail these songs. And the he's just a one of a kind. I mean, can you think of anyone other than, like, you know, Robert Plant? Robert Plant, right?
That's yeah, definitely.
Robert Plant and those kinds of guys. Like, it's hard to come up with another person who is, in fact, you could almost say Chris Cornell is better than Robert Plant, because Chris Cornell is like an excellent guitarist.
Easy!
But he's an excellent, because Chris Cornell is good on his own. Robert Plant, you know, he needs Jimmy Page.
That's fair.
The other thing is Chris Cornell is an excellent drummer.
Is he?
He originally was the drummer in the band.
Oh,
but
wow.
He was a drummer-singer.
Okay.
In fact, in the Ditto days, he would play drums and sing.
And
he would get a guitarist and a bassist with him to play these songs.
Little Phil Collins action. Nice.
Yeah. And so, super talented guy. It's sad. The final thing I'll say here is suicide awareness. We can all do better, I think, about helping people cope with depression and suicide. One of the best things you can do with regards to preventing suicide is human connection. Again, total speculation, but as with Robin Williams, is up in Alaska. Wasn't he up in Alaska?
Yep.
And
he was isolated.
Isolated. Yeah. When you're on tour, you're stressed out, you're isolated, you're spent.
Isn't that ironic that you're amongst so many fans that are adoring, and yet you must feel pretty isolated?
Well, if it's the one thing I've learned upon doing this podcast and investigating a lot of these Amy Winehouse, this sort of thing, is that when you're that famous, it has a massive negative effect on your mental health. The amount of energy mentally you have to put into it, and the amount of the onslaught of abuse that you'll, especially a woman like Amy Winehouse, that you'll get from the media and other people, and then the amount of substances you have to take just to stay regular.
Right.
You're jet lagged. You're all out of whack. And so, and then again, the isolation. He's away from his kids. He's away from his wife. He's probably away from maybe some of his friends. I don't know. And if there's a significant suicidal motivation, then it's perhaps going to get worse in those situations. I mean, at this point, upon investigating so many of these cases, and frankly, having clients that live this kind of life, when I hear about people going on tour, all I can feel is pain and suffering for them.
Oof.
Because it's actually, you're like, you and I, if we went on tour, we'd be like, yay, it's fun.
Yay.
There's like crowds of people like, oh my God.
There's 10 people.
Yeah, there's 10 people who will listen to our stupid music. But for these people, this is how they make their living. You know, they release albums, but in today's economy in the music industry, from what I understand, all your money comes from these tours.
Absolutely.
And so
selling t-shirts.
So it's not necessarily something you're doing for fun. And especially if you're this stage of Soundgarden, you're playing 20-year-old songs. It can't be that fun, especially night after night after night.
Right.
And so
he might also be like, maybe I'm projecting here, but there might be some frustration that, like, maybe they want a new hit, maybe they want a new album, maybe they want, you know.
But again, I suspect for Chris Cornell, it was ongoing depressive and suicidal thoughts that culminated in probably a number of bouts in his life in which he was, because I work with people who have significant suicidal thoughts, and when I work with them for years, you'll just see, if you have to see this graph of motivation for suicide, you'll just see it kind of going up and down over time. Mm. And sometimes it's just random, and sometimes it's related to their life. sometimes it's both, and you'll just see this ebb and flow. And over, and if one of those rises in motivation matches up with enough circumstances, then that's when it happens. And I'm guessing that's what happened to Chris Cornell. I don't know, of course, it's all speculation, but I suspect that's what happened. The reason why I'm saying this is because there's a temptation to look at this story and think, you know, how could this happen? He was at a show performing, and then hours later he kills himself. It could feel like, can anyone just suddenly kill themselves?
Right.
And yes, the answer is yes, but in all likelihood, if you really knew Chris Cornell, I'm sure his close friends and his wife are saying, well, he, you know, it was only a matter of time before, you know, is my guess. The other thing is people probably will start thinking there's foul play, which of course there could have been.
Yeah.
But given the circumstances, it doesn't seem like that's likely. Yeah. All right. Well, let's end this episode. Thanks for joining us. Well, I'll play that song, the cover song. Remember, it's a cover, and I recorded it 20 years ago, 21 years ago.
Wow.
Boot Camp by Soundgarden. Thanks for joining us. Please take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.
You deserve it.
You deserve it!
Oh, that was actually pretty good. I must contain my views. There must be some